This is Jennifer Ford Ziegler, and I am continuing my conversation with my mother, Esther Basaldúa Ford, or Maria Esther, but she goes by Esther. So, Mom, just to continue with your background, the family background through Grandma's side, your mom's side, you were talking about her parents and her father, Pedro Candelaria, who you and the family called Popo, and I think you probably went by other names in the community.
Yeah, they called him Mr. Pete.
Mr. Pete. Everyone did?
Well, not the Hispanic community, but you know, the people downtown. Oh, there's Mr. Pete, Mr. Pete, Mr. Pete.
And they knew him because he translated for them?
Because he was the translator.
Okay. Wasn't he also known as a healer? Or maybe a curandero, even?
Well, he wasn't really a curandero. When you think of a curandero, that's someone usually Hispanic who uses herbs and sometimes prayers to heal people in the Hispanic community. The stories that you heard were about his healing through, mother says it was like laying hands on people. What people would do is, you know, a lot of them couldn't afford doctors, and there were very, very few doctors in that little community. But he was known as a very, very literate man who was very knowledgeable and that had certain powers of being able to heal people. And usually he wouldn't advertise or anything. It was just word of mouth. And he didn't do it very often. He didn't like to do it, but he would do it for people if, you know, they brought their sick infant and would say, you know, por favor, would you heal my son, my baby? I it's been running a fever and I can't get it to stop. And so she said, mother says, I did get to witness one time, you know, when he was doing it, and he would just kind of close his eyes, and he would, I don't know if he was praying or saying some kind of thing, affirmation or something, and he would just kind of place his hands over the baby, the one she saw, it was a baby, and then they would sit there and relax. And after a while, the mother would say, you know, the fever would start to go down. And she would say, oh, gracias, gracias, Mr. Pete, and leave. And since then, I've read that, you know, he was a Rosicrucian. Part of his reading was he would send away for books from the Rosicrucian Society. And they do believe in healing using some kind of energy.
Like
healing. But you're not supposed to accept money for it, you know, because then that's a misuse of that ability, and you will lose it if you do charge people. But my grandmother couldn't understand that. She would say, oh yes, here they, you let them wake you up in the middle of the night, and then you don't even, and when they offer you money, you turn the money away. Your family could use that money, you know. Such a foolish man, such a fool. Whatever, why are you such a fool? And he would just ignore her and go back to his room and
read.
And read, yeah, mostly read. But I do remember when we would go to visit, he was always the first one up. he would wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning, no matter what time we went to bed. And he would get bored. So he would come around to the grandchildren, take a, you know, a piece of the broom, you know, take a little straw out of the broom, and then come and hover over you, and he would rub it lightly on your face like it was a mosquito or a fly, and you would swat it away, you know, in your sleep, and he would just laugh, and then you'd open your eyes, and there was Popo just laughing away like it was the funniest thing in the world. It didn't, and we would laugh too, but, you know, it wasn't really a lot of fun to be woken up at 6 o'clock in the morning after you'd stayed up late. But part of a sense of humor, I guess. But that's a story. He wasn't really a curandero, but he was a Rosicrucian. He was also a member of the Masons. They started a local chapter there strictly for the Hispanic men.
Oh.
And Blanche, my Aunt Blanche, was the one that told me that she has a picture of him. They had with his Masonic lodge.
I didn't know they had Hispanic chapters. And this would have been back when?
Back in the 30s, 40s. So that's the story of his healing.
Well, so let's move on to Grandma, who grew up in that household. So first off, tell how many children did Momo and Popo have, and where was Grandma in that line?
Oh, let's see. There were 4 girls, 4 boys. There were 8 in all. First was Pete Jr. He was the oldest. Then it was Jesus, Chewy, they called it.
Oh, I remember Chewy.
No, I'm sorry. No, I take it back. It was my Aunt Rachel was the oldest.
Oh.
So it was Rachel and then Pete Jr., my Uncle Pete, Uncle Chewy. And then there was a lag time. They were all pretty much like a year and a half in between the in children, except for my mother. There were 3 years between Chewy and her. And later on, I got the story about that. But after her, there was Leonardo. That's the one we called Nayo, Uncle Nayo. And then it was my Aunt Carmen. And then the youngest one was Gilberto. That's the one we called Uncle Gil. The 3 years between my mother's birth and her brother were because apparently I got the story from my aunt, my great aunt, but also different members of the family. What happened was when the war broke out, the First World War, my grandfather and his brother, Antonio, were pacifists, and they did not believe in fighting in the war. So, in order not to be drafted into the war, they went to live in Mexico until the war was over.
Huh.
And that caused a big rift in the family because my great-grandfather, my grandmother's dad, thought that was horrible, to leave your family just because of your pacifist beliefs. My grandmother went to live with them on their little farm and took her three children at the time. And so he said, that man has no sense of responsibility to his family, Anyway, that caused a big rift. Later, when they came back, there's another story associated that they're finally making up and being able to get back together. But I heard from my cousin, who also collected these family stories, that they really had a hard time in Mexico. They couldn't find a job down there. So they wound up, smallpox that was rampant down in Mexico.
Oh, gosh.
So the only job they could get was picking up bodies and taking them to cemeteries because of the smallpox epidemic. They had a wagon, and it was their job to pick up the bodies from people and take them to the cemetery to bury. So it sounds, it doesn't sound like it was any picnic for him to be away from the family. But he just felt like it was his personal belief, and he did not believe in killing another human being, and he wasn't going to do that. So anyway, so it was four boys, four girls, and she was kind of in the middle.
Okay. I remember Rachel, who deserves another interview just on Rachel. We'll get to her later. I remember, I'm surprised that there were so many years between Nayo and Chuy, because I always thought they were like twins. They seemed inseparable. They seemed very similar, too, in especially sense of humor.
Well, I may have the sequence wrong. It may be that they were closer in age. But it wasn't that they were really close in age.
But they were close and they were similar and
they
bonded.
They were similar and they bonded in personalities.
So what do you know of Grandma's upbringing?
Well, she, being the middle child, she had a very flamboyant and very ambitious older sister.
Rachel.
Raquel, yes. She was more of a homebody, She was very close to Grandma, and she was the one that Grandma taught how to cook. Yes, Momo taught her how to cook. Come on, Soyla, let's start supper. And so she was the one that really learned how to make tortillas and made the best tortillas in the family, and that remained until she died. Everybody just felt like their tortillas could not compare to Soyla's tortillas.
I believe that.
You remember that you all used to come to our house to eat? So she was the one that became kind of the family cook. She actually went to school. There was a little one-room Mexican school for the Hispanic kids. They went to their own school. And she went as far as the eighth grade. And then she said, I didn't want to go to the high school because they only had one high school for both the whites and the Hispanics and the blacks. There might have been a few blacks in the community. She said, but I did not want to go. I begged and begged my father. I said, please don't send me. I want to go to work. I'll go to work and I'll bring money for the family. She said, because the white kids used to be really mean, she said, to Hispanics. There were a few Hispanics who were brave enough to go to the school no matter what. She said, but they used to throw rocks at you and, you know, just not include you. And in fact, they were downright rude. And so I didn't want to put up with that. So I quit school in the eighth grade. And for a while, she went to live with an aunt that was here in Victoria. And she had a baby, and her older child was sick. She had tuberculosis. So she needed help with the baby. And so they sent my mother over to be a sort of a mother's helper to her. So she spent about, I think it was 2 years with my aunt Michaela, helping her out here in Victoria, and then went back to Sinton, where I think she worked a little bit there in Sinton, but eventually made her way to Corpus because the jobs were more plentiful in Corpus. And she and two other friends worked in a laundry, I believe, in Corpus.
Did she ever work the crops?
Well, of course, when they were little, they all kind of worked the crops when they weren't in school in the summers. She didn't particularly like that. And that was another reason to learn to be a really good cook, because the cooks stayed back and just cooked the meals while the others picked the cotton.
Is that why she was so afraid of snakes?
Yes, she was afraid of snakes because of that. I also think it was because of the story about my dad's family. He had a great uncle that lived in Sinton and picked cotton. And whenever he was stubborn, mother would say, "Yes, you're just like your great uncle so and so," and I would ask about that, and she says, "Yes, he was such a stubborn man, and it eventually caused his death." And I said, "How?" And she said, "Well, he was out there in the field, and he got bitten by a rattlesnake, and he went back, and they said, oh, here, let us, you know, we need to take care of that and take you into town and maybe take you to the doctor." And he kept saying, no, I'm going to get that snake. And he says, "Where's the machete?" And he came back for the machete, and he said, "I'm going to go back and get that snake." And so he went out looking for that snake where the snake had bit him. And he finally found it, and he killed it. And then he came back, but by that time, his leg was just completely swollen. And when they tried to take him to the doctor, he died.
Stuff.
Anyway, she would say that, you know, "Don't be stubborn like your..." And I wish I could remember his name. Like El Tío Jesucito or something like that. But and so she instilled a fear of snakes in me, too.
Yeah, she didn't like it when I had a pet snake.
No, she hated your snake.
So how old was she when she met Grandpa? And When did they, what was their story?
Well, she says that he had been a friend of her older brother, Pete and Rachel. She says, "You're older than you claim to be," you know, because he had to establish his own date of birth. Because I remember you used to hang out with Rachel and with Pete, and I was about 4 or 5 years younger than you. And he'd say, "Oh, well, you know, it doesn't matter, you know, 4 or 5 years, what difference does that make?" But anyway, no, she said she had a boyfriend.
In Sinton?
In Sinton. And they had gone to the movies, I think. Well, her boyfriend was from another small town, Robstown, which was not far away. But, you know, sometimes they would congregate wherever there was something going on in these small towns. And he apparently couldn't come into town. And all of a sudden, my dad, with another friend, appeared in town. And they had heard that he had gone to San Antonio to get a job. And he had. But apparently he had gone back to visit his friends in Sinton when he had a day off. And he went looking at the house to see if she was there.
Zoila?
Zoila was there, yes. And they said, "No, she went to the movies. You might go look at the movies." And yes, he found her at the movies, and he said, "Well, we're gonna go and get something to eat, and then we thought we'd go riding around and see what's going on over at the park, because sometimes the teenagers would gather at the park. Probably to drink, too." But she didn't say that. And so apparently from there he said, "Well, you know, there's really nothing going on." And he had gone into town. And she said, "I thought you were living in San Antonio now." He said, "Yes, I am. I'm living with my brother and I've got a job there. Got a job as a waiter there, but I came back just to kind of visit old friends." So he said, "And besides, Eugene, who had driven the car and driven him into town, has come to elope with his girlfriend here in Sinton." And when he said that he was going to come and elope, I said, "Well, I'll go with you. I've got friends, and I'd like to see how my friends are in Sinton." And so he said, then Eugene joined him. And he said, "Well, where's your girlfriend?" And he said, nah, she crapped out on me. She said she didn't want to get married after all. And so, you know, it's all right, to hell with her. So then they said, "Well, there's nothing going on here. I think there might be something going on in Beeville. Let's drive to Beeville." So apparently they drove on to Beeville.
With Grandma? With Zoila?
Yes. She was with Chalo. And then by that time, she said, "Oh my gosh, what time is it?" Once they were in Beeville, They found the party, and she said, "Oh my God, I'm going to get killed. I'm going to get killed, because nobody knows where I am, and here it's midnight. By the time we get back, it'll be after 1 o'clock in the morning. My parents will just kill me." And he said, "No, no, no, they won't kill you. The party's almost over here." And so then she said, "No, I'm a ruined woman. I'm a ruined woman now, you know, because
you kidnapped me and took me to Beeville."
And took me to Beeville. And he said, "Well, let's just keep going to San Antonio then." And so we'll go, and you can sleep at my brother's house. And so they went on to San Antonio, and she's crying because she's a ruined woman. And they got there, and my uncle Cristobal and his wife said, "Why have you brought Zoila?" Because they knew her from when they lived in Sinton. And he said, "Well, it's a long story, but, you know, she felt like she couldn't go back because her family and her brothers would just kill her." And they said, "Well, she'll have to sleep in the living room, and you'll sleep in the kitchen because you can't sleep together. You're not married." And he said, "Well, okay, then I'll marry her." And he said to her, "Look, I'll marry you. Then you won't be a ruined woman, you know. I'll tell him that, you know, we just eloped, you know, and Eugene was going to get eloped anyway, and that didn't work out for him, so we'll elope." And she thought about it, and she thought, "Well, I guess I have no choice."
Better than being killed.
Better than being killed by your own family, or, you know, having the reputation of a ruined woman in town. So anyway, they got married. He went to a pawn shop and got a ring, and they got married the next day, and they called long distance.
How did her family react?
Oh, they were not happy, but at least they figured, you know, she's married, and they knew my dad had grown up there. They knew he was an okay guy, you know. But still, they weren't happy about the whole situation. And
What about the boyfriend in Robstown or whatever? Lost to history.
Yep, he didn't come into town that weekend. He lost out.
But do you think they loved each other, obviously.
Oh, yes. I mean, she liked him okay, but it wasn't as if they were
madly
in love or anything. And she used to say, you know, I came to love him, and I found out he was actually a very responsible and a very, you know, caring person. And Dad was a charmer, you know that.
Oh, yeah.
And she said, and I always kind of had a crush on him, but I knew he had dozens of girls, you know, because he was such a charmer. He had girlfriends everywhere. So I never even thought that there was a chance that I could be his girlfriend. So she always felt like she accidentally wound up with a chunk from Sinton, with the big hunk.
The Casanova.
The Casanova.
Wow. Well, why don't we stop there?
Yeah. So they got married, and they were still living with Uncle Chris and his wife, but he had 5 children, and they were in this small house. So he kept encouraging, he said, but you can stay until, you know, you find a place to rent or a place to live. And, you know, so Dad was saving his money, and he decided, you know, I really don't want to rent. I want to own my own house. And anyway, after work, he used to go and shoot pool. He was an excellent pool player, if you remember.
Yes.
When we had that pool table. So the story goes, one time he walked in there, and there was a guy there that was sort of halfway drunk and just bragging about how he could shoot pool, he could outshoot anybody, he could outplay anybody in that place, and drinking. And so Dad thought, I think I could take him. He watched him and watched how he played, and he thought, I want to challenge you. And so he said, I kept challenging him, and I would let him win every once in a while, but then I would win. But enough so that he wanted to keep playing. And so he kept playing him, and
For money.
And each time he would go ahead and say, well, I'll put in the whole thing if we play again. And the guy would say, sure, I'll. And then he would beat him. And so finally, the guy was getting kind of angry. And by that time, he was so drunk that he really wasn't shooting as well as he could. So he ran the table with all the money that he bet, all the money that he had won.
Chalo did?
That evening, the guy.
Oh.
And yeah, Dad too. He said, I'll play you for the whole thing. And Dad said, okay. And he beat him. And
so then he had a lot of money.
Then he had a lot of money, and the guy got angry. And Dad said, hey, do you even have enough money to get home? And the guy said, Dad said, hey, I'll tell you what. He said, I'm going to buy drinks for everybody, on me, everybody, because everybody was cheering, had been cheering all along on this game. And he said, turned to the guy, and he said, now, do you want some of your money back? And, of course, by that time, it became a sort of a reason not to accept money from him, because everybody, of course, had gotten drinks from him. Everybody was on Dad's side. And so he, I guess, had hoped that he would start a fight or something. But when he saw everybody, having their drinks and talking about what a good game it was, he backed off and left. And so Dad went home, and he said, it was enough money to buy a little lot that was for sale right in not too far from my brother's neighborhood home, my brother's home in this more or less the same neighborhood, but not too far. And so he bought the lot, and then with his earnings, he and his brother just built a little two-frame house on the weekends, and they moved in there, and that was...
Wow. Yeah. He got it shooting pool.
As a pool hustler.
That sounds like Grandpa.
Yeah. He was a character. He was, like Charles says, Dad was larger than life, you know. He was something else.
He was cool.
He said Dad was cool before the word cool came into being. He said, I can never hope to be as cool as my dad.
Well, the fact that he knew to buy everyone a round of drinks so that he had them on his side, and then maybe so he could make a clean getaway too without being mugged. He understood people.
Yes, he was a great psychologist.
That's where you get it from.
I had to go to school to learn it.
Okay, let's stop it there, and then we can talk more. Okay, I will say, I will not be able to resume this interview if I say, yeah, no, that's fine, because there's only